Welcome once again to Riding Right with the Raiders, where the truth rides tall and Texas stands free. As always, God bless America and God bless Texas. Joining us today is State Representative David Lowe. Thank you again for taking the time to join us here at Texas Tech.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're definitely happy to have you on, and we've been waiting for this podcast episode for a while.
Oh yeah, we were very much following the legislation. In fact, I was up in Austin at least once for the Republican convention, and it was pretty much all anyone wanted to talk about was what was going on during the session. So we're excited to finally get to have this conversation.
Well, good. It was definitely an experience, right? I started out as a intern in college, and like most people, I would never run for office. I'm a behind the scenes kind of guy, but it was definitely an experience that I'll never forget.
We're going to go ahead and dive into our first topic here, starting with incrementalism. A lot of young conservatives can tend to be impatient until they kind of learn how everything works. So you came into office as a freshman. Did you ever feel any pressure to compromise? Or were there moments where you felt like you had to choose between making progress or making noise, would be one way to put it?
Oh, yeah. So, before I was even sworn in, the speaker's office had an opposition file on me. And they knew where I went to college, where I went to high school. They knew all this stuff. And so they started exerting pressure from the very beginning. And, little conversations at the very beginning are if you want to get things done, you got to play ball. Like, they'll make little passive aggressive comments and things like that. I will tell you, a lot of the compromising that I saw was in committees. People saying, hey, I know you want your bill heard. Well, I need my bill heard. Or I need you to vote this way or that way. I remember a representative on the House floor was supposed to said that I am not going to support your bill, or I'm not going to support this representative's bill unless they take my amendment. 30 minutes later, the same representative got a talking to from leadership, dropped their amendment, and voted for the bill that they weren't going to vote for. So there's a lot of pressure, but I was kind of like the unknown. Nobody knew how I was going to react to things, so they kind of left me alone. So
that's interesting, because I've got a friend that works up in Austin named Andrew Sinclair, and one thing he and I talk about sometimes is, the public, they don't really know what goes on during these sessions and what it takes to get bills put in place, to get stuff passed, the agreements, the compromises. They think it's just go in there, talk, sign a document, and you're done. And that's not really the case, is it?
No, not at all. Look, a Democrat passed, I want to say 11, a Democrat freshman passed 11 bills out of the House. And 9 bills, I believe, were signed by the governor. Because she played ball. I am a freshman. I had one bill pass the House and none went to the governor. So they try to set the tone from the very beginning. It is so much different. I was very critical, and I still am, of the Texas legislature and a lot of the reps. However, I will say things are a lot more difficult than I realized. For example, you can author all these great bills, and then you can go home and say, well, leadership killed my bills. But did you actually fill out the formal paperwork that required you to request a hearing on that bill? If you didn't, and a lot of people don't do that, they want to say, I authored the bill to get rid of toll roads, but they don't even fill out the paperwork to get it a hearing. So, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, that's definitely something we experience here, even in West Texas, is a lot of smoke and mirrors where people don't realize everything that's going on behind the scenes, what's actually happened with boots on the ground. But when you talk about incrementalism, I had a lot of things come to mind when I read that in the email. And I think a lot of people don't understand, not every bill is going to be perfect. Sometimes you've got to water them down, get them where they need to be, because then it's harder to get them out, and then go to work on amending them so that they can somewhat resemble what they were supposed to be and do what were intended. Can you kind of talk about incrementalism a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm going to actually use the pro-life movement as one of the talking points for incrementalism. The pro-life movement has passed over 1,500 bills to limit abortion since Roe v. Wade, right? We've had some monumental victories the last few years. However, they still continue to pass bills just enough to go home and tell their donors, hey, look what we did, even though it doesn't really affect anything, so that they can keep the money train going. Border security. You know, we kept passing these tiny little border security bills when we actually could have stopped the invasion here in Texas. We could have actually built the border wall. We really could have enacted E-Verify and 287G program mandatory across the state the last few decades. I understand that not every bill is perfect, and you kind of, like property taxes, you got to work on it a little bit piece by piece. But one of my criticisms is we have had the majority for over two decades. There is nothing we can't get past. Look, SB3 is a hot topic right now, and I voted for it, and I'm more than willing to tell you why. But that one, for example, that went all the way to a complete ban of THC products for recreational purposes. It wasn't incremental. So we get to pick and choose. The legislature likes to pick and choose what they do as incremental. And really, a lot of the incremental wins are just enough legislation to go home and say, I did something. So they can put it on a mailer so they can get reelected. And that is one of my biggest frustrations as a freshman, as an activist.
Now, that's one of the things for me that I get real frustrated with. Like, I'm a little bit older than my peers at Tech because I didn't go to school as a kid. I was sick. My parents took me out because of it. And then I got a GED later on in life. And then eventually I got into politics while going to school. And it is something where you watch people play ball, and they go back and forth, and they go home, and they pat themselves on the back, and it's like, wait a minute, why is everyone cheering? Nothing really got done here but some names on paper that, you know, when you really sit down and read it, it's legal jargon that means nothing. And that's a frustration that's even felt in young conservatives across the board, and I would go as far as to say across America. Because we definitely are getting frustrated with a lot of the stuff we see in certain situations.
I totally agree. Look at property taxes. Okay, we raised the homestead exemption from 100 to 140. Great. But how many people's homes go up more than 40 grand over just a couple years? Whereas there was no real desire to tackle the appraisal system, which is really one of the biggest problems that we have. I just want everybody to remember, we can do anything we want. We had the majority in all three branches of government, but we choose not to. But then again, the average incumbent wins 95% of re-elections. So
for now, at some point, I would love to talk with you about some stuff that the younger Republicans in Texas have got going on that I think would really excite you. The stuff that you're dealing with, I got to ask, how do you stay committed to your principles while working within a system like that?
Well, in December, when we met after freshman orientation, on the last day, the caucus met together. The entire Republican caucus met to vote for who the caucus nominee for speaker was. You know, everybody shows up with their suits and ties, and I showed up with my banned Democrat chair shirt. Because at the end of the day, I'm still an activist. I still believe I'm grassroots, whether I'm elected or not. And multiple people said, hey, David, you're not an activist anymore. You need to take that shirt off. And I refused. And to be honest with you, one of the reasons I feel like so confident in my voting and whatnot, I don't want to do this for a living, right? I've been retired since I'm 32 years old from the Army, right? I get a nice retirement check. I've got a nice life. Things are going well for me. I don't want to do this for a living. So at the end of the day, I get to vote my conscience and I get to vote the conservative values. And if I don't win re-election, then I get to go back to spending more time with my family. I do think that there are a lot of reps out there. This is their entire life. It's like, you know, the high school football quarterback star. He can't give it up. And some of these reps are the same way. They just can't give it up. It is their entire identity. And my identity is not a legislator. I might be a legislator, but I'm a husband and a father and a Christian first.
Thank you for actually saying that, because that's something that I think a lot of the younger future politicians really need to hear. Because even I'm new to student government, right? I never wanted to get involved. And now I'm involved. It is eye-opening because things don't work exactly the way I thought. But you do get frustrated, and I had to come to terms with, okay, well, I do have some allies, but with the stuff that I want to do and the way that I want to take action and push back and get stuff done, I ran basically on a Republican platform for the most part, and it's just a lot of the stuff I want to do is not going to get done, and it's going to be incremental things that maybe if we get more conservative Republicans in it one day, it'll change while I'm here. And if not, it doesn't happen. Okay, I had fun. I got to learn more about parliamentary procedure, and I'll go on. But even, and you may not be familiar with this, or you may be, I proposed some legislation up in Austin. When I did that, I have a separate document with that, and it says why Republicans and conservatives should support that. And I put God first in everything I do. It is in that document. And to me, that is really important. You keep God and family first, because now in the modern era, there's a lot of people, you ask them, oh, you want to go into politics, or you're going to school, what do you want to do? I want to be state rep, senator, governor, president. So you're in it for a career. Yes. You should not be in this for money. That is not what this is about. So thank you for saying that, because that really hits home. And I think a lot of younger people miss the mark on what it really means to be a conservative Republican and a Christian in politics.
Let me just add on that this job does create good opportunities for folks. And there are people that are conservatives that get offered business opportunities or investment opportunities and things like that. And so that's why they stay in it for so long. I think that I can see how after just the first few terms, you can really get sucked in. For example, I go to my office during session. These people are kissing up to me, right? You know, oh, it's so great to see you. They don't care about me if I didn't have the title state representative. So I think people get attracted to getting their asses kissed all the time.
You're absolutely right. I've got titles that I don't like using them unless I have to. And then it's just kind of like, okay, well, I know I don't look like it, but here's who I am. Here's some titles. Here's what I do for y'all. And, you know, I don't go in there and expect people to throw stuff at me. A lot of people, and I think Caleb has kind of seen this a little bit, they think I've got money and pull that I really don't have. It's just I care enough and have the passion and the courage to stand up and say, hey, this is happening. This needs to change. Nothing's happening. I'm going to take action on that, and we're going to start making some progress. But then you do, you have the other people where they want the attention, and it's almost like watching state reps nowadays as someone in my 30s that watched it growing up. It almost feels like you're watching a popularity contest, and in some ways you are with elections, but it's more politics have gone to the side in some sense, and it's just favors upon favors, business deals, a lot of glamour. And so someone like you, hearing what you said, to me, that tells me you still have a soul, and that's really refreshing to hear, because you don't hear that out of a lot of politicians nowadays.
Well, I will say I took some tough votes this year, some that I was not expecting. I knew the school choice vote was going to be tough. The hemp or the THC, recreational THC ban was a tough vote too. And at the end of the day, I believe in both those things. And if I lose re-election because of them, then I lose re-election because of them. I think politicians worry too much about the political outcome. And because we all have consultants that we pay year round, and we're just and those people want us to run for re-election, and they want us to raise as much money as possible so we can spend it, so they can make more money. So I guess you just got to go back to remember, like, why did you get into this in the first place? And if it's a genuine reason, then you've got a clean conscience.
You know, and you're talking about re-election, and we have the primaries coming up, but you were a freshman going into this, so what was the, I guess, biggest eye-opener during your first session?
The biggest eye-opener going into my first session, I really think it's how polite I was expecting to go in there and everybody be absolutely a jerk to me, knowing who I took out, and nobody could have been, well, other than a handful of people, everybody was so nice and professional and cordial. And when they say member, you know, because you're a member of the Texas House of Representatives, it's crazy, but they really do treat you like family. I remind myself, these are not my friends, these are my colleagues. But that was actually the biggest eye-opener for me, is how it feels like a family atmosphere. My birthday just passed, and reps that I would probably never agree on anything with text me happy birthday. I mean, they stop me in the hall and say, hi, how are the kids? Like, it was a very friendly atmosphere for the most part until the end of session. Then everybody. Oh, and the other thing I want to say is people's true colors really come out. For example, I had a representative that took one of my ideas and took it to another legislator, who then asked me to start transferring the bill to them so that they could get a hearing, because I was a freshman and I couldn't. So, and this freshman stabbed me in the back. So it is what it is, but you see people's true colors.
Yeah, that's, and I think that kind of happens or can happen at all stages of government. Because we've, just in Lubbock, Texas, we've seen politicians come up with ideas like, there was a politician, he had the idea to put chips in all the dogs that we catch in the city. And that way we know what dogs are coming in, which ones are getting back out, and it leads back to the owner so that then the city can in turn issue a citation to the owner and penalize them for their dog getting out, because that's just a big problem in Lubbock. We have packs of dogs roaming the streets. Doesn't matter if it's a rundown part of town or a brand new part of town. It is what it is. It's out of control. And that was one of his ideas. And another politician came along and said, you know what, I'm going to put that in my documents, and if I ever take office, I'm going to use that. And so, yeah, that is something that happens, and it's unfortunate. And that's why I'm so careful with legislation that I want and pushing it through of who I take it to, because in my experience, I've had Democrats that they love that I support patients that want an education at college. They love that I fight for disabled students. But if I'm not careful, that gets turned into DEI, and that's not what I'm doing. I'm trying to facilitate patient access. And if I'm not careful and they take my documents, they'll start tacking on gender dysmorphia or something when one section of my stuff talks about PTSD. And I'll be like, no, that has nothing to do with patient access. That is nothing with this. That's a whole other topic and issue, and that's not something to accommodate at a university. My stance on PTSD was, we've got a lot of veterans. We've got people with medical PTSD from procedures like I have had. Let them start their semesters a week or two early. That way they have time to get it together. They have a little leniency, and it allows a little wiggle room on them getting their education and dealing with what they need to deal with. But it really sounds like you've kind of summed up my second question. So I'm going to kind of jump over that one and ask, what was something you would like to tell incoming freshmen to kind of watch out for or advise them on?
It might not be directly to your question, but let me first say, if you really enjoy politics, you really enjoy policy, don't get a degree in political science. We have too many people with poli-sci degrees. We need people with experience in different fields. We need a variety of thought. And so I would say anybody coming in and like a college Republican wanting to get involved, just jump off the ship and just start swimming. I want you to immerse yourself into this. If you really want to pursue a career with it, just become a precinct chair, right? Go block walk, go volunteer for a campaign. Just get out there and go do something. Like me, I made coffee and copies at 32 years old while I was going to community college right out of the Army. And, you know, I actually, one of the first jobs I applied for was a district director, you know, working at the district office. And everybody told me, oh, you don't have the experience for that. So, you know, so you can just follow your own path. Everybody has their own path.
Thank you for saying that, because I'm one of the few also that, you know, I'm not a poli-sci major. I'm pre-med. I'm really debating getting my MD, JD, and just going after what I know from experience. And I've actually told the Texas Federation of College Republicans, I don't know if you're familiar with them or not, but I was like, you know, we need to really expand our reach. You've got so many conservatives and Republicans that if you were to tap into medical students, your engineers, your, I don't know, what's another degree, Caleb?
There's quite a bit.
We need technology. We need technology.
I'm an ag major, and it drives me to basically keep the land as natural as possible and try and keep everything afloat with agriculture and making sure all our farmers and ranchers are getting what they need, because agriculture is a dying business and sometimes it's a struggle.
I hear that. I want people to also know that you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to be an A student to be a politician. Look, I struggled with reading. I joined the Army because I was not good at school. I didn't have the maturity to go to college. And I'm not a 4.0, right? I don't know all the different issues inside and out. But if you have confidence in what you believe in, you have strong convictions, and you work hard, because that is really the hardest thing or biggest thing. Work hard, and you can do whatever you want, no matter what anybody says.
We're talking about stuff that matters a lot here. Now is a good time to dive into this. And that's talking about property taxes, why they matter, why it's a top voter issue. After your first session, do you think Texas is on the right path towards getting property tax relief that'll be substantial?
No. And let me tell you why. Number one, we are going to have a constitutional election in November. And including myself, are going to vote to raise the homestead exemption from $100,000 to $140,000. All of the politicians are going to go home in the next few weeks, and they're going to brag about providing amazing property tax relief. And voters eat it up. They say, oh, we never get enough. But then they still drink the Kool-Aid. As long as politicians are rewarded for providing half-assed measures and property tax relief, there's no incentive to change. And I feel like that's a pretty honest answer. You know, we talk about property tax relief, but then the legislature also passed reducing, lots of counties are going to multiple year appraisals. And they just passed a bill to require annual appraisals, right? But they won't send a mailer about that. They'll just send a mailer about raising the homestead exemption. So, you know, politicians are talking out both ends, and no, I don't think there's the appetite for it. Like, I authored a bill to eliminate property taxes. I learned a lot this session. Now, looking back, I didn't really like the bill that I offered to eliminate property taxes, but I at least wanted it to get a hearing so that we could move the conversation. I'm also a member of Young Americans for Liberty. They're a great organization. And something that stuck with me that they promote all the time is the extremes move the middle. And so I think that while eliminating property taxes is a noble goal, the more we push that, the more politicians are going to want to at least provide some relief. But yeah, I would not expect any property tax substantial reform to be provided in the next few sessions. But we're going to fight like hell. We're going to try to put the right people in the right places to make that happen.
And that's definitely, and I want you to know, I'm not going to name drop who she is. There's a member on our state board that is very passionate. She was very honored to work for you. And your younger conservatives, your younger Republicans, they're watching what's happening. They're disgruntled. There's definitely communal unrest across the board in the U.S., and especially Texas right now, with, I would say, age 40 below. And also, just while we're on the topic, Young Americans for Liberty, they've also reached out to me. They want a chapter here at Texas Tech. I am in talks with them. I'm just as sick as I am. I can't spread myself too thin, but I'd love to get with them, get with you after this sometime, and figure out what we can do to help get that going. I'd love to be a part of that. I love what they stand for. But going forward, we know your bill didn't pass. And looking back, there were some things you didn't like in it. Having said that, do you support anything this session that you would like people to know that involved caps on property tax, compression, or some type of appraisal reform, even if it didn't pass?
Yes. First of all, look, people, the number one issue, Republican and Democrat, is property tax reform. I don't care what anybody says. That is the number one issue. I offered several bills, and something, just to throw this out there, I offered like 40 bills, right? That's a lot of stuff to keep track of, unless you're one of the senior members. So it was way too many bills. I learned my lesson. So I will probably do no more than 10 bills next session so I can actually focus on them. And one of my favorites is requiring 2/3 majority in order to raise a property tax rate above the no new revenue rate. Another one is requiring counties to do appraisals every 3 years to provide financial stability. We can raise the homestead exemption, but if we don't actually reform the appraisal process, the homestead exemption is not going to make a hill of beans. And then also requiring 2/3 majority in order to pass a bond, because Texas, including interest, owes over $500 billion in bond debt. School districts around the state, you know, that's the largest portion of everybody's property taxes. Most school districts are paying over 30% of their property tax revenue to debt. It's not going to teachers. It's not going to helping anybody. It is going to service debt. And so I think the only way we actually see real property tax relief is providing reforms. And, you know, the governor actually, in his opening address to the state in January, said he would like any rate above no new revenue rate to require 2/3 majority. I thought maybe somebody had leaked to him my idea, because I had never heard anybody else say that before. But that is really super important. And yeah. Also, I would just like to throw out a suggestion. We have lots of college Republicans, very smart, capable, intelligent Republicans. I have been running eliminating property tax bills through ChatGPT and other AI programs over the last week and a half, and I'm asking lots of questions, getting lots of data. I would love to see maybe the college Republicans or some other organization come up with various solutions for eliminating property taxes, because I think that the thing is nobody actually thinks it's possible. The math doesn't work based on the plans that I have seen. So that's, we're trying to fit a round peg in a square hole.
That's an interesting take on that, because we've actually, that's some of the stuff we've looked into here at Tech as Tech College Republicans. There's other things too, different interstates, water issues, but that, you know, talking about property taxes, I think the other question is, because a lot of these students, they live in dorms or they're just not seasoned enough yet. And so I'm real big on promoting civic literacy and other stuff so that they understand what's happening around them, not just at their university, but how do we make these issues easy for young voters to actually care about?
You know, I've always heard, you might be a Democrat when you're young, but you'll be a Republican when you're older. And I think that it will just take some life experience and getting out there for some people to see the problems that need to be addressed. But I think you have to be living under a rock to see that we don't have major issues that affect all different demographics of people. And so getting involved, a well-informed voter and a well-informed activist is an effective activist. So.
And I'm just curious on this one, because LIS, well, not LISD, yes, them, but school bonds, that was a big topic this year. And you're talking about property tax. And I argued at one point that an increase in property value is the same as raising taxes, because when property tax goes up, your taxes go up. It's just a play on words and what's actually happening. Looking back on that, I still stand by what I said. I'm not inherently against school bonds. I do recognize there's a problem. I don't think building state-of-the-art facilities when we're still in debt is the answer to that. But is there a way to potentially address property tax issues when building new school facilities?
So I do believe that we do need new school facilities, but I keep hearing from school boards and teacher organizations, everything, the life of the school is only 30 years. Well, I don't know if you know this, but they change the carpet in the Texas House of Representatives once every 30 years. You have got to learn to live within your means, and you've got to expand on existing infrastructure and make it work. We have all of these different facilities, stadiums everywhere, and they spend 90% of the year empty. But they require tons of maintenance. They require additional employees. So let's say you build a bond for a new stadium. Okay, fine. That increases the debt. But it's all of the other stuff that affects the M&O, the same M&O that pays teachers. So I don't think school districts are really being that genuine when they talk about a lack of funding. You know, the average elementary school kid, average high school kid, they cannot read, do math, or do science at grade level. Yet we are still building these state-of-the-art facilities when the way I look at it is my children were not able to run until they could crawl or walk. It's time to get back to the basics. When I got sworn in, school districts would come to my office and I would express these concerns with them. And they were like, well, these kids need to have after school programs because they're going to be running the streets and this and that. Look, public schools are not daycares. Public schools are there for public education. We have a culture crisis, but our property taxes are supposed to educate people, not be their entertainment. So I really think school districts own some of the responsibility of the financial negligence. However, I will also tell you real quick that I talked to a school district in my district, and I talked to them about the bonds, and they said, well, the voters approved the bonds. Yeah, but you have the fiduciary responsibility to not vote to put it on the ballot if it doesn't make money sense. The average person doesn't know how long it's going to take to pay off that bond or what it's going to do to the local population and the property taxes. I forgot to add, I also had a bill that required the total debt plus interest balance to be put on the ballot next to every bond.
Issues like that, that's also, and in my opinion, I think there is a lack of accountability there. I've really been debating pushing the issue of when you have a superintendent in place and then the person who's over the school board and over them and they appoint them, it's really hard to get those people out of office when they're not doing what they should. Case in point, if a school board says or has a committee, and that committee, that oversight committee, says, oh, we recommend a $2 million bond. What's happened here is they turn around and say, hey, here's a $5 million bond. And I'm like, wait, that's just way, and I'm just throwing numbers. Those numbers aren't accurate, but that's just an example of what's happened here. And that's also why I think there needs to be accountability, especially since some of those people are elected officials. And also, I'm against the whole, you can appoint someone into a position of governance leadership and then they're untouchable, because that does not seem very conservative or constitutional to me at all. But that's kind of the way they work right now.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Everybody wants to blame the state for property taxes. The school districts want to blame the state for not having enough money. And it's really frustrating because all politics is local. And I think that we need to start holding our local elected officials as accountable as we want to hold state officials. You know, a lot of the times I have found that the superintendents obviously they're running the school district, but they keep things from the school board. And I actually don't like the superintendent being the most powerful person in the school district, just like I don't like the city manager strong form of government. I don't even like the Speaker of the House being there without being elected by the people. The most powerful person there should not be appointed. They should be elected.
Yeah, we definitely feel that even at a college level. That's definitely become a grievance on Republicans and conservatives, because there is a feeling at different universities. Does the person running my university, are they really this out of touch with us? Do they understand what we need versus what we want, what we care about? And when there's no accountability, in my opinion, you create bad leadership. And that's all I'm going to say on that.
Well, the school districts, it's an industry, right? I keep harping on the school districts, but they are 60% of the property tax, your property tax bill. And they act like they are the victims. They just got $8.5 billion more dollars. I would like to just point out one quick thing since we're on this topic. School choice, right? I know a lot of people don't like school choice, and that's fine, right? It's a divided issue in our party. However, we spend, including federal tax dollars, about $18,000 a kid. You give them a $10,000 voucher instead of the $18,000. For every 100,000 kids, we save $800 million. So if we can really expand the school choice program, there is potential to save billions of dollars, and that shifts some of the property tax burden away from the homeowner.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that version of the argument, because I've been I pay attention to people like Ashley Cash and others, and school choice was one, but I have not heard that version of the argument. And that's real interesting. You know, and this is going to go into a little bit of a hotter topic, because we've been having just some out of control protest about this, but border security and E-Verify. Did you happen to support anything that dealt with border security this session?
Yeah, we had the 287G program, which would require, you know, local law enforcement, jail or sheriff's offices, jails to work with the federal government to get rid of these individuals. But to be honest with you, because of the president and how active he's working on this issue, it's almost like there was no appetite for it. Let's just wait for the federal government to solve all of our problems. E-Verify, for example, there was a bill, an E-Verify bill, that would have required all government workers to go through the E-Verify system. And I told this bill author that I would vote against it. It was in committee. And, you know, with all the Democrats voting against it, if I voted against it, it wasn't going to pass out of committee. Well, why would you vote against E-Verify? Because the government doesn't hire illegals. They hire contractors who hire illegals. That was another example of, let's just pass something to say we pass something instead of actually accomplishing it. Because if we passed a totally weak E-Verify bill, next session, when we try to change it, like they do this often, oh, we already handled that last session, we don't have to deal with that again. So, you know, they could have made the changes that I requested, but they chose not to. So I don't feel bad for not supporting it. So it never made its way out of committee. I believe it did not. At the end of the session that we were voting on so many bills, I remember going to the House floor one day, and I asked my staff, the person, you know, that worked for me, how many bills? And this person said, 430 bills. How are we going to vote on 430 bills? So I'm literally reading like 20 and 30 bills ahead of every vote that we had. So
Oh man, I bet that felt like you were back in college preparing exams before you took your first one.
Well, you know, there's like, if a bill had like 10 pages, I would actually just put the bill number in ChatGPT and say, give me bullet points of this. And I'll be honest with you, I used AI quite a bit on the House floor to help me like understand some of these very complex bills in a very quick way. So,
I mean, but you kind of have to, because some of them, y'all don't have hours to sit there, stand there reading. What does this mean? What does this mean? Where was this section 10-4A subsection B 7? That, I mean, at that point, the session would never end.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was often teased. Supposedly, I am the number one no voter in the entire House with 41%. And if there were so many bills that if they gave me like a tingle of this is not a good idea, or they're trying to cram it through without giving us all the details, I voted no. I'm going to bump that 41% up quite a bit next session, though.
Yeah, I think that's also environment. I think if the right bills were getting passed, it may be a different number.
100%.
And that's going to be the thing. And people like to spin it. Well, he voted X amount negative no. Okay, but do you know what was voted no on? Because the context really matters there. And people don't realize that. But we have another question here. But with local jurisdictions, do you think undermining state efforts is really an issue, or that it might even be the other way around?
Are you talking about, say, like a city chooses not to enforce a particular law, like the 287G program?
Yeah, or maybe the governor does something and says all cities in the state of Texas, sanctuary cities from now on, and then the city is just outright no.
I'll be honest with you, I have to put a conservative bend on the issue, because if all cities were sanctuaries for the unborn, I would totally support that, right? Right? Because I don't support the killing of the unborn children. However, if they were to say something like, we will help pay for transportation to abortion clinics, right? Then I'm absolutely against that. So it's kind of tough, right? I believe it was that, don't quote me, but I believe SB 15 removed the ability for zoning restrictions from local municipalities. And I was totally against that. Property, I support property rights of owners. However, I do believe that zoning plays a very important part of how our cities and counties work and their structural makeup. Just remember, I am a conservative. I am not a libertarian. I do believe in sensible regulation. I don't believe in no regulation.
And I think that's something a lot of your younger conservatives, they often find themselves at odds with, because the more you go into it, the more you have to dissect it. You can start to question what you're doing a little bit, especially when you get into zoning. And then there's a lot of weeds when you get really dive in to politics and legislation and stuff like that.
I totally agree. I will say that these are very complicated issues, and I look for other members that I trust, which is very few, but I look to them because, you know, maybe they're a developer or an attorney or something like that. So I kind of look for their expertise sometimes when I have questions like that. And I think that it's also important to know that, you know, Some of the outsiders, and I say outsiders, I still feel like an outsider. You know, you might see a bunch of comments and how people feel about a particular issue on any specific bill. But I learned that in my position, I'm having meetings with stakeholders consistently. I'm getting data that is not readily available for everybody. So there is information that we consistently get that isn't always published online, which kind of helps amend our decision making a little bit. Also, I have actually changed my vote several times based on the floor debates. So,
yeah, I don't think people realize there's information they don't have access to. I'm not going to say they don't need the access to it, but I mean, the fact is you're going to have conversations that the general public is not going to hear. Doesn't matter who you are, a husband and wife, that happens. And it's different in every situation. That's just part of life. I'm going to try to tie these next two topics together. So, you know, with Texas, you could fit multiple states in the state of Texas. Is there anything you think we should do as far as border security? And do you think that border security might tie into election integrity somehow?
I do, I believe as far as border security goes, we honestly, what I would really like to see is the Texas have its own border wall, right? Well, what about the federal government's border wall? Well, we saw how poorly maintained and even removed it was under the Biden administration. So there are a lot of things that we could do to better secure our border and remove criminals or illegal criminals, which all illegals are criminals, from our lands. And I think that we must continue to be active in that. And as far as election integrity, I 100% agree that we need to secure our elections to a meaningful level. It doesn't matter if it's illegals or convicted felons or people that are voting at multiple addresses, or there's a whole host of things. We have got to do a better job of securing our elections. I have to give props to Collin County. They recently announced that they are going to go to serialized paper ballots. Europe does not use electronic voting machines. I think it is time that we get rid of the machines across the state. Remember, though, if you want paper ballots in your county, you can get paper ballots in your county. You don't need the state to do that. The question is, do they have the desire? Do they have the willpower to do it? Cheating happens on both sides, both parties.
I'm not sure if you know this or not, and this was just something somebody told me last election. I was told that, like, if you're a senior or you're so old, you can have, like, if you're disabled enough, you can have the ballots or the voting document taken to your house, fill it out. They'll be there to supervise it. You give it back and they take it back. Are you aware of anything like that?
I haven't been aware of that, but you know what? Nothing surprises me anymore. Dealing elections in full context. I firmly believe the election was stolen in 2020. And I firmly believe that they will continue to try to steal elections. And let's not think that it only happens in other states. It happens right here. It happens in primaries, in our own party. There's all sorts of shenanigans that happen. And we have got to do a better job of securing our elections.
You're right. And we see that as college students. Even as a college student, we've seen third-party voting systems go down, extending student government elections. And in turn, when they come back up, hey, you got 2 more weeks to vote. Okay, cool. Okay, 2 weeks is up. Can we get the votes? No, we're having problems with the system. Okay, well, what's wrong with it? I would like to know the numbers. How do you know who won or who didn't? And they'll, and you know, the colleges are going to tell you that nothing goes wrong with their systems, even though they'll backfoot and say, oh yeah, something did go wrong. I do believe that happens a lot locally, because let's be realistic here. When you're talking about conservative numbers, and you're talking about statistics, it does not take many numbers to skew votes. You're talking about a minute amount of math to go in there to change the vote. And I think that is a problem. State reps and others, or government entities, like, I don't know if this was a problem. I'll ask in a minute, but I saw a viral video where there were voting issues during the session with some of the machines. And I just kind of tapped my foot and I was like, man, if it's this much of a problem, whatever happened to pen and paper?
Yeah. Let me first say, you know, the big four accounting firms, you know, like PwC, Deloitte, EY, and I forgot what the other one is. You know, they deal with top trade secrets all the time and secure financial data. I would love to see one of them go through the source code of these voting machines. I understand the voting machine manufacturers do not want to have their source code released because people can copy it, manipulate it, etc. But I do believe that we need a third-party examination of the actual written code that makes those systems work so that we can have a better idea of what they're truly capable of. And then secondly, the voting machines. So that's another thing that was a surprise to me. You know, I always heard, oh, these voting machines failed. They went in the journal and changed their vote. And, you know, the voting machines, if you hit red, it lights up red. It's physically impossible for you to hit red and it light up green or white. Same thing to the other side. Now, I will say, I have seen people hit the button and it doesn't light up. I've actually seen that because they are older and I really do think they need to be replaced somehow. However, you know, when we have, say, a verification requested and they go through all the names of who voted yay and who voted nay, and then they read off the names of all the people who voted, say, well, these reps meant to vote green and then they voted red. No, they were gaming the system. And it's really disgusting. I think that we've got to address that in the rules package next session. You know, they screwed us on the rules and basically did not allow us to offer any amendments to the rules package this year. However, that aside, I believe that the most important vote of the session is the rules vote, not even the speaker vote. It's the rules.
In your opinion, do you think that maybe a mandatory audit of machines or rules or a tighter registration law might help some of the loopholes in Texas election laws?
I do. I absolutely do. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, we have 150 members, 88 Republicans. And unfortunately, we can't get on the same page as far as election integrity goes. You know, you got some people who benefit from the lack of election integrity. You have some people that don't benefit. There's all these competing interests. So until, I don't want to give the executive branch too much power, but we need the executive branch to mandate some election or call some special sessions for voting integrity reform. Because really, the Texas legislature doesn't have the willpower to do that.
Oh, I've had a lot of younger people because we've really been pushing hard here in West Texas and Lubbock for conservative principles, Republican values, and transparency and record votes comes up a lot. And I wanted people to hear this for themselves. Why aren't old votes public in the Texas House?
Why are not what votes?
Why aren't all votes public in the Texas House?
So I don't think it's in the rules, right? You know, I would fill out a sheet almost every morning and I would actually have to write down every bill number. And I requested record votes on all these bills and all these amendments related to these bills. And so many members came up to me and said, David, you're slowing down the process. Please pull that. Why are you doing this? And I believe that everything we do should be recorded. I even think that we should, when we scan our badge to come into the building in the parking garage and we scan out, I think that should be recorded and everybody should know how long we've been in the Capitol. But it's all in the rules package. Look, when you do voice votes, people can get away with stuff. And, you know, that's not transparency. There are more record votes than ever before called this session by, I want to say, close to 1,200 votes. I don't know how many I called, but I called more than I, and there's no actual record of this, but because my desk is right next to the parliamentarian's table, I believe that I called more record votes than anybody else this session because people deserve transparency.
You're right. I'm of the opinion, and not everyone is going to be, and Caleb, you may have some thought here too. I believe it was Thomas Jefferson, and I tried to find the quote just now and failed, but I used to reference it a lot, and it talks about how laws are meant to change to reflect the society they are meant to serve and protect. And I think that's true because I think as society moves forward, some laws, they're still good. They're a good foundation. But I think sometimes they need to adapt to serve their purpose in a new environment. Saying that, how would you feel if there was a change requiring record votes for all bills, including committees?
So all bills in committee, all votes in committees are already recorded. But they make it really difficult to find those votes in the journal. I'm sure you've looked at the journal. It's like trying to play Where's Waldo. But yes, I want everything to be recorded. Absolutely everything. I also want to get rid of the local and consent calendar. Do you know what that is?
I do not. Go ahead and elaborate on that.
So I had no idea what it was. Basically, it's bills that affect someone's district locally. And they're in committee. And we can vote on them. Like I was in IGA, Intergovernmental Affairs Committee. And there were a lot of local bills like, oh, they want to create a public improvement district or a municipal utility district. And these districts are able to issue bonds and things like that. And people really got annoyed with me in the IGA committee because I voted against bond. So local and consent calendar is if these bills go on local and consent calendar, they're voted as a block on the House floor. Like 30, 40, 50 bills can be voted just up or down on that. And if one person in committee votes against the bill has to go on the general calendar like every other bill. And of course, I voted no on pretty much every local bill that came across.
I didn't even realize that bills like that made it up that far. That was new to me.
Yeah, me too. Like, why are we having to vote on a new water infrastructure for some small county in East Texas? I think that we need to change the law on how we do those local issues.
Do you mind if I ask you about your thoughts on a particular bill as a veteran?
Sure.
This is HB 5381, Military Children's Compact Bill.
That's mine. So basically what it did is it strengthened the compact already in place. And it was brought to me by somebody who's very connected with the Military Department of Education. And because I was a veteran, I found it interesting because veteran dependent or military dependents move around a lot. And sometimes they miss out on educational opportunities. And so this would basically streamline that process to improve the compact. However, it's important to remember that we already have a compact, and there are compacts across the entire country. So,
Right. And I've tried to explain to people the compact's already in place. Here's what it's really doing. This is a fact. Military children do move around a lot more than you think they do. Because someone's deployed doesn't mean their family stays where they're at back home. I've seen families, you know, hop and skip to different multiple houses within months times of each other. And I always assumed it was a problem, but until I met this particular person and they confirmed it, I can see kids missing out, falling behind, losing out on opportunities because they're not prioritized despite what their family is going through. And so I followed that one pretty closely and tried really hard to push it, but...
Well, you know, nobody wants... I mean, at least I got a bill out of the house, and that was it. It didn't have any fiscal impact. It could have been something they easily picked up, but, you know, they wanted to give me something at the end. It was like a rite of passage. Everybody gets a bill through the house. But if the bills go through the House too late, then they usually die in the Senate. And this is what happened here. But we will work on it and probably reintroduce it next session. It's a very simple bill. Remember, constitutional carry took a decade to pass. So, you know, a lot of bills, most really good bills, and I'm not saying this is nearly as good as constitutional carry, but what I'm saying is, a lot of really good bills took time to develop and then get passed.
We're talking about time to develop. And we're going to kind of change gears here a little bit and talk about tips for young conservatives and Republicans. What makes someone valuable to an office like yours?
Showing up on time, being motivated, and being able to... be teachable and flexible. And honestly, another thing, learning how to keep your mouth shut, right? There's a lot of things that go on. There's a lot of pieces. There needs to be a lot of trust. And so somebody has to be mature. And, you know, thankfully I had that on my staff this session. Not everybody did. You know, working in that building can be a career maker for a lot of people, or it could be a career ender. So you always want to leave a strong lasting impression.
But when you say flexible, are you talking like be willing to stay till 2 or 3 in the morning, or can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. That's one way. But what I'm saying is you could be working on policy, anti-abortion policy. And then you suddenly have to shift gears. And in the middle of writing your sentence, you got to pick up all your stuff and go sit in a bill reading group with other legislative directors and talk about property taxes. Then you got to run down to the House floor and give your member some paperwork to sign. And then you got to get back and finish a report. So you got to be on the move. Be able to be on the move, constantly putting out fires. Even though the chief of staff does that, everybody does that to some degree.
What do you look for when you're hiring or choosing interns or volunteers or your team?
Number one thing, are they a conservative? Because if they're not a conservative like me, we're just not going to gel. I personally would like to find somebody who's has a little bit of life experience, had tried some different things. And that doesn't mean age, right? You don't have to be 50 or 60 years old. But maybe you played a sport, or maybe you grew up in a different part of the state, or, you know, different backgrounds. What do you have to offer? Like, I look for diversity. Diversity is usually a naughty word. But then I also look for somebody who has demonstrated maturity in the past. I also try to ask questions in an interview to see if they'll always agree with me, because I don't want somebody to always agree with me. Like, I am an idea guy. Not everybody is. And if I have a stupid idea, I want somebody to tell me it's a stupid idea. I also want somebody, like I said, to be able to keep their mouth shut. Have they been able to demonstrate in previous times in their life where they have had information and they chose to do the right thing and not share it because they're, oh, and can they be compromised? That's something I try to really think about because the lobbyists, a lot of times they don't go to the members because the members are out on the floor voting. They're going to the staff members that are the ones writing the recommendations. And so you've got to have integrity for sure.
So as a college student, I know there's a lot of trouble with visibility. And Caleb, you kind of saw that during my little election, let's call it a fiasco. I know colleges have systems where they're, I don't know if it's an agreement or how this works, but student government members go from their university to interning in your office. But then you have other people that are activists and maybe they're also at a college or maybe they're not, but they would also like to intern. Is there anything wrong with reaching out to your representative's office and saying, hey, here's who I am, here's where I would like to do, here's a resume? Or what do y'all prefer when it comes to younger conservatives?
You know what? I think the first thing you do is just, I think if you go to like an event where a rep is, just make a first impression. Just shake their hand, say, hey, how are you? Blah, blah, blah. I would love to talk to you. Ask face to face because that's a great way to make a good first impression, if you can. Look, I love texting, right? Because I can text people all day way faster than I can talk. But a phone call goes a long way. A very personalized email. I would like to see more people that want to get involved volunteer first, right? Go knock doors. Not only does knocking doors help a candidate, it teaches you what people actually want, what policies are important to them. And it kind of starts to craft that mentality, that servant mentality. And it helps you message to the people a little bit better. It's important to remember, we are in the customer service business. Whether you're a state representative or a legislative aide, it doesn't matter. You are in the customer service business. And we have to be able to take information and execute with that information. And so meeting, honestly, I feel like door knocking is the number one thing, even if you want a career in policy and not politics.
All right, so let's just say you've got some young conservatives and Republicans, and they really don't know how to become useful to legislators, because there's a big gap between being like in Lubbock, Texas, versus sitting in an office in Austin. What is one thing we can do now to become useful to our legislators and future legislators?
Well, you know what you could do is simply, for example, yeah, Young Americans for Liberty, they have these conferences in the summer. Go to one of those. Just hear what people have to say. Watch some of these policy discussions, even at the federal level, from your dorm room. Get on conference calls. Subscribe to newsletters. Do not expect that you're going to learn a bunch of information reading comments on Facebook or Twitter. Get involved. Be a precinct chair. A volunteer. Be a phone banker for the governor's campaign. Like, there are so many different, what is passionate, what is important to you? Criminal justice reform is important to me. So I consistently, while I was working on my master's in public policy, I was consistently tuning in to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice's our quarterly events or meetings so that I could hear and get a grasp of what's going on. So Just find your own way, because everybody has their own path, but do something. Don't just stand on the sidelines and think, I wish I could, or I want to one day. Just do it. Find a way. There is no perfect answer.
I definitely appreciate everything that you've done and everything that you're basically doing. And I don't know about Kevin, but I've always had a strong relationship with some of my legislators back home because I'm from New Mexico, and one of my representatives was actually my baseball coach, and I got to know him a little bit because he taught me baseball. But it's just an amazing thing that everything that you guys do, we just thank you a lot.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. I like talking to normal people, right? I like to talk to people that are motivated and want to get involved, because that's how I was. Less than 10 years ago, I voted for the first time. Less than 10 years ago, I got my first internship, and now I'm a state representative. So amazing things can happen. You just got to follow your passions. Be passionate about what you do.
It definitely is amazing. And if you had any tips for young Republicans and conservatives to open up about their
beliefs, standing on principle.
The college area in general, it's kind of a shallow area to talk about politics, just because a lot of college students don't really know how to open up about who they really vote for and their beliefs.
This will put it in perspective. If we're tabling outside, we will have students come up and say, oh, you're rapists, you're pedophiles, or you support them. No, we're not. We're Republicans and conservatives. That's not what we support. That's not who we are. And so you've got an environment that's just, it's very hostile. People really want to go for the jugular right out the gate. And if you've got advice for them, we would greatly appreciate it.
So I was in college 9 years ago, and this stupid professor, you know, I'm 32 years old. I'm surrounded by a bunch of 17 and 18 year old kids in college class. And this college professor kept saying that young black men are being murdered in Chicago mostly because of police officers. And I stood up and I told him, I turned around, I looked at everybody. And I said, how dare you say that to all these young people who look to you as a leader? And then I stormed out. And I addressed the school board and I ended up leaving the college because I realized they were a bunch of quacks. But I think that, number one, you got to surround yourself with people that are like-minded. Be sure and immerse yourself with those people. Don't be afraid, in my opinion, to have some smart-ass remark back. Be confident in what you believe in, and to hell with everybody else. Whether it's a professor, your friend, your parents, it doesn't matter. Stand up for what you believe in, because it doesn't just make your stance known. It builds your confidence. I love the idea that I love the college Republicans. I wish there were more in it. The organizations like Yale and other organizations that are coming to college campuses, it is really exciting to watch. And I look forward to it, and I want to be able to support them in any way I can.
And I'm sure we would be very open and appreciative to that. Caleb, would you like to add anything?
I think he said it pretty well. And I honestly think this has probably been one of the best episodes we've had and one of the best end of podcast answers that we've had. Basically just saying, stand up for what you believe in and don't take no for an answer.
Yeah, you can't, especially in the environment we're in now. If you're silent, you know, what good was your voice? It's the same as the people, they didn't vote. You might as well have voted for the other person that you didn't support. And that's my take.
I want to add, just so your fellow college Republicans understand, stuff you do right now. And if you Google me and all the attack ads, you will see that stuff that you do online now can bite you in the future. So it's time. If you're really serious about this, sure, go out, party, have fun. Don't post it online, and start realizing that your social media presence is your resume.
That's a really good take on that. I've kind of wondered, a lot of us will take our political stuff to social media, and I've wondered about that at different levels. You know, are we ruining our future, or are we putting our voice out there? Because it's kind of a double-edged sword. But no, you're right, because it's sad what the internet has done to a lot of careers and potential leaders.
Yeah, it is. But you know what? I as a Christian Republican believe in redemption, and I believe everybody can be forgiven. You know, except for pedophiles. I don't think they can be forgiven, but that's just me.
You're definitely not alone there. All right, Caleb. Thank you, everyone, for joining us again for Riding Right with the Raiders. And again, I'm Kevin Allen.
And I'm Caleb Jensen.
And we'll catch y'all next time.